So welcome. Thank you for putting up with probably one of the most talkative guided meditations you've experienced at IMSP. I'd like to tell you a little bit about how I came to all of this. Oh, dang, I forgot the picture. Oh, well. I don't remember the chronology at this point. I had an undergraduate degree in psychology, and it's been an abiding interest. So if any of you are familiar with the work of Hansen and Mendius, you'll know I cribbed a lot of this talk from one of these CDs. This is one of several that they've done, and it's a 3-CD set, and I recommend it highly. But stepping back a bit, one of the first things that I encountered along my meandering path to brain-based meditation is Jill Bolte Taylor's TED Talk, My Stroke of Insight. And then I was so smitten by the talk, I bought the book by the same name, where she goes into much more detail, and it has drawings. It's a picture book. So you get to see what part of her brain got blown out. She is a neurophysiologist at Harvard, and she had a massive, massive stroke and watched it happen. She watched her mind disintegrate, and the way she tells about it on the TED Talk is unbelievably powerful. The book doesn't touch it, but it does have more stuff. Recommend it highly. I'm going to hang out for a while at the end if anybody wants to come up and touch my realia. I'm an ESL teacher when I'm not here, and I like realia. The next thing I encountered was MindSight, The New Science of Personal Transformation by Daniel Siegel. He works primarily with young people, but the book, the bulk of the book is case studies, each of which, of course, is more than just one person collapsed into one fictitious person to protect whomever. A great read, very fast-paced read, a lot of science in it, but explained in ways that he explains it to his young clients, so they can grasp the concepts. So even I could get it. And then that really got me going. Along the way, Shaila, our primary teacher here, became involved in a research study headed by Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and invited some of us who had a lot of meditation experience to apply to be considered as research subjects, and Ed and I got in. So we went to Madison 3 times and had all kinds of brain scans, and I forgot to bring the picture to show you what the inside of my brain looks like on an fMRI. But those 2 books and those experiences of sitting in the lying in the fMRI machine and a bunch of other things that are unspeakable that we won't talk about got me very interested in this neuropsychological research. And I found in my local library, Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain. And I thought, well, that's a title I can get behind. This is written by Sharon Begley, who is the science writer for the Wall Street Journal. Not a fast read, but packed, really packed. Excellent journalism, excellent writing. And Richie Davidson's work is featured pretty much throughout. A lot of stuff about the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan Lamas that have... the Dalai Lama invited Richie Davidson to Dharamsala and asked him to begin researching meditation. He said, you guys in the West, you're great at looking at what's wrong, but you don't look at what's right. You know, maybe you get to zero, but you don't get in the plus part of the scale at all. You know, let's look at happiness. Let's look at contentment. Let's look at peace. Let's look at transcendent states. So If you're interested in any of those things, they're featured in this book. And along the way, I get lots of, well, only two anymore, book catalogs, and this came my way, lavishly illustrated and a terrific, terrific guide for the layperson for, as Rick Hansen said on Sunday, the 3 pounds of tofu inside the coconut. You know, I have never been involved in a course of biology that talks about the brain. I've never been done a dissection or anything. And this is a terrific guide for understanding what's where and what connects to what. And then I was too cheap to go out and buy the book as a pig in the poke, but I checked it out of the library, and while I had to put my name in on the waiting list, so while I was waiting for it, I checked this out of the library, and I said, I'm going to buy the book. But then I got it out of the library and read it, and then I bought the book. And these people are terrific. I just found out on Sunday, Rick, the other Rick, with the M, said, Rick Hansen said, he says his name Mendias. I've been mispronouncing it all along. Anyway, they both go by Rick, Rick Hansen and Rick Mendias. Mendias is a psychoneurologist. He really does the neurology, but he also has a counseling practice. I think he's in Southern California. Hansen is up here in Northern California. He has regular classes in San Rafael and was on the board at Spirit Rock for, I think he said, 9 years. So they've been going to Spirit Rock and giving talks. And for a long time, I was seeing these talks and I was thinking, you know, this is just pop psych. This is way too commercialized. And then I got the stuff, and I'm a convert. Sunday was another talk. Unfortunately, Mendias had a family emergency, and he wasn't there, but Hansen did the entire day by himself, talking to individuals through all of his breaks, including his lunch. I don't know how he did it. You know, I wouldn't have the voice for that, but it was brilliant. He moves seamlessly from a very deep understanding of the Buddhist texts without using any jargon, made it very, very clear. And we've been working with Shaila's Sutta study for years, since she's been offering it here through IMSB. And, you know, complete concordance with the stuff we've been reading from the Pali text in translation. And making the fairly esoteric neuropsychology ideas quite comprehensible. He has a book and a website, Just One Thing. And they're very, very brief. They come once a week, and they're sort of inspirational, you know, a sort of, what is it, the Harper series? Anyway, I can't recommend this guy highly enough. The two of them are brilliant, and this was, I don't know, it doesn't have a price on it. $17.95, worth every penny. So that's sort of a lengthy summary of how I got here. And I find it endlessly fascinating. So going back to the talk that I cribbed from Mendias from the CDs, we're going to start with suffering. A lot of Buddhist talks start with suffering. And looking at the causes of suffering, Hansen on Sunday said that his interest in the intersection of neuropsychology and Buddhism is where they intersect on the causes of suffering. Buddhism is looking to discern the causes of suffering in order to liberate us from that suffering. And Hansen is interested in looking at the substrate of the neural architecture for the causes of suffering. So with that said, there were three strategies for survival which have evolved over the millennia that are embedded in us, throughout us, but especially concentrated in the brain. These strategies kept our ancestors alive and allowed them to pass their genes on ultimately to us. The strategies include an animal, including us as animals, attempts to create a boundary between self and other. There's an inside and an outside. An animal tries to stabilize what keeps changing in order to maintain internal systems within tolerable and very narrow ranges. And an animal tries to seek out and hold on to pleasures, food, sex, comfort, and avoid pains, attacked by predators or enemies, satisfying the pain of hunger and the pain of thirst. So there's a built-in seeking out of opportunities and avoiding threats. There are, however, as I'm sure you're aware, problems with these strategies. So as much as the animal tries to maintain a boundary between self and others, everything is in fact connected. So there is a boundary that's quite apparent at the epidermis, but there are holes, and the outside keeps going in and the inside keeps going out quite regularly. And the boundary is really quite blurred, right? Food and drink go in and go out, and air goes in and out, and light goes in and creates stuff inside the 3 pounds of tofu inside the coconut. So there's a lot of, when you really examine the boundary isn't as tidy as we want it to be. And as much as we try to stabilize things to keep the internal environment within our narrow, tolerable ranges, everything keeps changing. And as the outside changes, because we are interpenetrated by the outside, the inside keeps changing. And this desire to keep things from changing isn't just limited to what's inside the body and the narrow ranges of tolerance. We sort of overgeneralize the desire to keep things from changing. Served us well for all these millennia. Hey, let's take it to the big time. And the last one, as much as we seek out opportunities and try to avoid threats, opportunities are often unattainable and threats are often unavoidable. I think I want this in cross stitch, you know. So because these strategies are really in fundamental opposition to reality as it is, we wind up creating a lot of our suffering. So there's suffering, dukkha, the pain of hunger or the pain of injury or illness. And then there's the Buddhist second dart, the pain that we add to the physical pain. We suffer that we suffer. So the good news is, because we create a lot of our suffering, we can actually train the mind to not automatically create any more additional suffering. So this is where Hansen is looking at the causes of the causes. How can we intervene without neurosurgery, but just with directing our thoughts? How can we intervene in what's going on in the brain to reduce, or if possible, eliminate some of the suffering from our suffering? So this leads us to the idea of neuroplasticity, a 75-cent word for the brain changes itself. The architecture, the actual tissue of the brain, is constantly rearranging itself. There's neuron pruning. When there's too many neurons for something going on, it just they're done away with. And when there's a lot of activity in an area, that portion of the brain, either a portion of the cortex that is involved in that function, expands into other adjacent portions of the cortex, or what they found really quite surprising, the cortex actually thickens. So relatively recently, they've determined that meditation actually thickens the prefrontal cortex. There's more brain tissue in areas of the brain in long-time meditators than there is in non-meditators. And the fellow who is sometimes called the father of neuropsychology, a pioneering neuropsychologist, Donald Hebb, coined the wonderful catchphrase, "If it fires together, it wires together." So the way the brain works is as these signals are moving back and forth across regions of the brain, as the neurons in the regions fire in synchrony, then whatever is that process, the cause and the root and the response to that process, is much more likely to happen again. So if it fires together, it wires together. And basically, that's the foundational concept on which that guided meditation was built. So I'd like to kind of unpack it now. excuse me. The assuming the posture and establishing the intention activates the frontal lobes of the brain, which sends orienting and priming messages throughout the brain. This is top-down neuropsychological organization. The frontal lobes are responsible for our goals, planning, and directing action, manifest action, and it shapes emotion. It's not the direct region most involved in emotion, but it shapes emotion by guiding and inhibiting the limbic system. So the cortex is the most recently evolved part. Cortex means bark, so it's the outside part of the brain. And that's the one that you've seen in pictures that's all kind of... Somebody in the class on Sunday said, it looks like noodles, like big, fat, wide noodles in tomato sauce. You know. So anyway, that's the cortex, that's the bark. And then underneath that, the cortex is sort of, Hansen kept referring to it as the primate human layer of the brain. And underneath that is the limbic system, which is, Hansen referred to it as the mammalian brain. And then the brain stem underneath the limbic is the reptilian brain, the oldest part of our brain. And the reptilian and to some extent the limbic are not particularly plastic. There's not a lot of neuroplasticity going there, but we can influence them by this top-down neural functioning. We can't really change it as we can change the cortex, but as Hansen said, we can tip it into a more neutral or possibly even positive mode of functioning, not so much the negative reactive mode that seems to be its kind of default setting. So intention is really important, and I think that's a big takeaway that I got from their talk on the CD, that we can return to the intention, we can return to the verbal mediation to initiate this top-down influence of the actual brain architecture. The next two things that I invited you to try were relaxing the body with the deep breathing, the longer exhale than the inhale, and the focusing on the sense of feeling safer. So relaxing the body with the inhaling and the yawning. The inhaling brings oxygen to the brain. The areas of the brain that are more active draw more blood flow, more glucose, more oxygen. They need that in order to do that neural work. And the yawn and the smile There's a guy, I think his name is Schaefer, I'm not certain, at University of San Francisco, who's done a lot of work on facial expressions and found that there are, I think, 7 or 8 sort of universal facial expressions. He even went to, like, the jungles of the Amazon or something, or, I don't know, Borneo. And everybody has basically the same facial expressions. And facial expressions work in the other direction as well. So if you put your face in an expression of an emotion, you can elicit the sense of that emotion internally. So a smile isn't really a smile until the muscles at the corners of your eyes crinkle. So if you don't smile hard enough to make that work, inside you don't feel like you're smiling. So no Botox. Okay? You won't ever really feel like you're genuinely smiling. So the smile actually does buoy the sense of yourself and the sense of what you're about. There's a lightness. You know, if you genuinely smile at someone, you sort of light up inside. And that holding that sense of the crinkled eyes and the yawn at the beginning helps support the mind as you begin this really effortful task of holding your attention to one object. The longer exhale activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which is an antidote to the more adrenaline-driven sympathetic wing of the nervous system. The sympathetic wing is the one that responds to startle and activates the muscles, gets the liver to squirt out a bunch of glucose, and you know, you're ready to fight or flight or freeze. And the top-down messages from the frontal lobes calms the limbic system, producing a feeling of relaxation and contentment. It quiets the overall activity of the mind. Earlier I said that the intention primes and orients the entire brain to relaxation and a quieter, less noisy level of activity. And being in that mode, it actually supports contemplative insight. More on that in a second. And by calming the brain, it calms the tendency of the brain to scan the environment for threats and to react to them. Evoking the positive emotions tends to stimulate the dopamine reward circuits. Everybody's probably heard of dopamine, and I don't really understand it. I just heard what I heard on the CD. But one of the things that Rick talked about on Sunday is the dopamine level in the brain is kind of like the gatekeeper for attention. So you need to keep dopamine levels relatively high and relatively stable. If dopamine drops beyond a certain threshold, the attention, the gate to the paddock opens and the little attention critters go out and they wander around, right? That's his metaphor. I liked it. And similarly, if there's a spike in dopamine, you know, a jolt of, the gate drops. Like, you know, the thing that came to my mind, this isn't Rick, this is Drew. If I was trying to meditate and somebody went by with a plate of fresh-baked chocolate chip cookies, gate down, you know, it's like, attention is not on the breath anymore. You know, so you want to keep it high so that it can't spike. And that's one of the things they found when they were studying these long-term Tibetan meditators. The dopamine levels were like maxed out. The chocolate chip cookies wouldn't have touched them, you know. And it was stable. They could maintain it for hours. Extraordinary. So we want to keep the dopamine reward circuits gently stimulated. And further, the evoking of positive emotions encourages surges of norepinephrine, another neurotransmitter, which alerts and brightens the mind. How often have you heard the meditation instruction, you know, if you're drowsy or if your mind is sinking, brighten the mind. Lift yourself up by your bootstraps. How? How do I brighten my mind? I mean, you either automatically know how to do it or that doesn't tell you anything. So the bringing to mind a positive emotion or noticing a positive quality in your meditation right now and noticing the somatic, the body corollary of that positive emotion, that positive experience. Hansen talks about turning positive facts into positive experiences. So you bring it to mind, you summon it to mind, and you intensify it by giving it mindful awareness, and you let it sink in. And that gives the surge of norepinephrine, and that brightens the mind. So now you know. Dopamine also inhibits working memory circuits. So this goes back to supporting contemplative insight. Quieting the working memory circuits makes the brain less responsive to new stimuli, so it's not drawn away from the object of awareness. It allows the attention to stay on one object of awareness. So we have that, I didn't rehearse it and I only remembered in Pali. Vitaka Vichara. In English, please. Applied and sustained thought. So we can apply it, but then how often have you had the experience of you can really get in touch with the breath and then a little while later, you know, like 6 or 7 breaths later, it's kind of boring and kind of hungry and wonder what's for lunch and I need to go shopping and I forgot to buy eggs. And, oh, the breath, you know, right? So this keeping the attention on the object of awareness is effortful. And by gently suppressing the brain's interest in looking for new stimuli, it supports keeping the attention stable on a relatively uninteresting object. And it needs to be relatively uninteresting because you don't want a lot of agitation. You want the mind to settle down. And both of those neurotransmitters prime the brain to make new connections. So this is both explicit and implicit memory, and I'll talk about that in a minute, and allows us to absorb the lessons of meditation. So the dopamine tends to support contemplative insight, and evoking the positive emotions tends to preset the brain to absorb whatever insights arise, whatever awareness we have of the body states, the body-mind states of meditating. Refreshing the intention from time to time resets these dopamine and norepinephrine circuits. And it, again, helps the attention to stay focused. So it's a very simple technique. If you have a short, sweet little intention that you can go back to in just a few words, it, again, engages the frontal lobes, the executive functions in the mind, and sends the messages down into the limbic system that, again, helps the mind collect on the chosen meditation object. Taking in the good primes the memory circuits, especially implicit memory. And the difference between implicit and explicit memory, looking at it in the result of how it appears to us in the mind, explicit memory is a thought or awareness that comes to mind with the sense, the metacognitive awareness, this is a memory. I'm remembering this. Sometimes I think it gets scrambled, you know, with deja vu, but Hansen didn't talk about that. That's just me. So implicit memory is where most of our experience gets stored. We are not aware of being aware of all of the stuff in the room or the temperature or, you know, a lot of stuff that is impinging on us and entering our unconscious awareness, and it goes into implicit memory. And things like our expectations, our models of relationships, our emotional tendencies, our general outlook on life, and our sense of what it feels like to be me arises on the foundation of implicit memory. So taking in the good somaticizes a conscious experience and allows it to make the connection across the implicit-explicit divide. There's a problem with memory, as with our three basic strategies. Memory has a negativity bias. It tends to selectively scan for, register, store, recall, and react to negative stuff. Hansen says, the brain is like Teflon for positive experiences and Velcro for negative ones. So if you think about it, you know, evolutionarily, those proto-potential ancestors who were just sitting around totally blissed out and, you know, there's all kinds of rustling in the grass behind them, but that's cool, you know, chomp. They're not our ancestors, right? So the jittery ones who tended to jump at every rustle in the bushes are the ones we got their genes, right? So it kind of makes sense. But like he said, I mouthed his words earlier, you know, Mother Nature doesn't really care how that makes us feel. She's more concerned about the fact that our genes stay in the gene pool. So taking in the good helps to compensate for the brain's negativity bias. So that's kind of the why of all that talk in tonight's meditation. And the good news is that memory is actively reconstructed every time it is recalled. So unlike a computer file where it's all there somehow in a biological analog of ones and zeros and it comes back intact, it's more like a paint-by-number canvas and the brain just fills in all of the blanks real fast. And it happens so fast that we feel like the memory has come back entire. However, it comes back each time a little bit tweaked. And the good news is it's tweaked in part by the state of mind into which it enters when it is recalled. Similarly, when you stop paying attention to a memory, you're not remembering it anymore, it is what they call reconsolidated. It goes back in outline form. But as it is reconsolidated in memory, it also takes back with it some of the fragrance, some of the flavor of the state of mind in which it was recalled. So one of the ways to work with negative material, and if you're working with real trauma, please get professional assistance for this, but if you just have kind of everyday stuff, maybe not my mother, but you know, if you just have everyday stuff, you can summon up, you know, troubling memories, and I haven't really mastered this, but Rick says you can maintain them kind of in background awareness. So for me, it feels like kind of touching into it a little bit and then coming back to staying with the positive emotion, you know, working on the positive emotion, and allow that to be there. And since I can't really hold two things in my mind at once very well, I find attention really kind of flickers back and forth, even if I think I'm multitasking. So it feels to me like I can dwell with the bulk of my time in the more pleasant, positive emotional state that I'm evoking or intensifying, and then touch into the difficult material. And that then, when you stop thinking about that difficult memory, it will reconsolidate, taking some of that good stuff with it. And Hansen on Sunday made a good point, which I don't think was in the CD or the book that I noticed, but we're not doing this to cling to the pleasant feeling that we get when we are having positive emotions. We're doing it in order to cultivate wholesome states. We actually change the brain. We train the mind to dwell in a more wholesome, more positive state of mind. And that becomes the lens through which we perceive our reality. So just to recap, fundamentally, the brain is structured and it functions in ways that make it kind of the source of a lot of our second dark kinds of suffering. The boundary between ourself and others isn't as we think it is. It's really much more porous and diffuse. Exactly where it exists is a little woo-woo. So as we try to maintain I'm me and you're you and never the twain shall meet, we create suffering in that struggle. Similarly, trying to maintain systems in unchanging states when everything is changing, including us, we're locked in a losing battle. And seeking opportunities and avoiding threats, my favorite quote, opportunities are often unattainable, threats are often unavoidable. So going back to the Buddha's instruction on liberation is the goal is to see things as they actually are. So this is like we've got millennia of hard wiring to fight against seeing how things as they actually are. So if you're not liberated yet, be patient. You know, it's going to take a little while. So we can work with the brain directly via our thoughts in order to promote positive inner states, neuropsychological states, that not only support meditative practice, but more broadly support the cultivation of wholesome states in all aspects of our lives. So any questions, observations, feedback? Lisa.
I have the good fortune to go down and get like 4 days of critical stress incidents, intervention, training, and psychological first aid. And while we were doing that, there was a lot of talk about the amygdala and how experiences can belong in brands.
Yeah.
And I kind of on and off kept hearing about this like eye movement therapy stuff. And
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, whoa, can we have
yes.
So she talked about it, and she basically described exactly what you said that Rick said, which is to kind of put memories in an adjacency where you kind of
use the
And that's basically what PTSD is, which is, and so the rapid eye movement thing is kind of resembling REM sleep, which is the time at which our brain goes, okay, let's take these memories, we're going to file them back here, kind of away from the limbic system, I think.
Uncoupled.
So therapy of seeking, how do you put it, good mind states.
Yeah, positive mind states. Right. Yeah. So one of the things that I read about PTSD is in extremely traumatic situations, conscious awareness shuts down. And the memory floods into implicit memory. So when that material intrudes into conscious awareness again, it doesn't come back with a sense of this is a memory. It comes back with, oh my God, this is what's happening now, and I've got to kill him. You know, so it's really very, very powerful, and we can work with it directly. And most of us don't have anything bordering on PTSD, but we have things that intrude into consciousness in ways that surprise us or disconcert us. And I think that one of the powerful things that comes out for me with this approach is that we really can begin to work with the executive function and accepting what might have otherwise been experienced as intolerable, understanding that it will pass. You know, so it's the Buddhist in observation of anicca. You know, it's impermanent. Pay attention to the impermanence and notice it. And when it's gone, notice that it's gone. Savor that. Somaticize it. So you're actually putting stuff directly into implicit memory. Great, thank you. Any other questions? Jen.
I have a question about daily practice. So say you have established a daily practice where you're meditating around the same time every day, and say that some day you're in a negative mind state, and it's a rather strong one, and so you're having trouble with your prefrontal cortex executive function saying, calm down, this is really not so bad, and so your mood is really strong. Is it wise to postpone meditation in that case when your meditation is then going to be infused with this very strong negative state?
Did everybody hear the question? What if you're in a strongly negative state when you're trying to meditate?
Before you sit down.
Yeah. I really think that there's no hard and fast rule. I think that you really need to be gentle with yourself, and if you feel this is just going to be overwhelming, do something other than gut it out and try to bring up some positive emotion. So we're looking at, as Hansen said, the causes for the causes of the suffering. So the negative mind state is causing some suffering. And there's something going on that we can't necessarily diagnose, you know, in the substrate. And maybe trying to meditate right then is not wise action. And doing something, you know, if you're prone to enjoy bubble baths, take a bubble bath. You know, be gentle with yourself. You're a wholeness. You're an individual. You can't be divided up into the good me that meditates and the bad me that's in a bad mood. You know, you're it. So short of that, I think that attending to the negative mind state, again, if you can sit with it and say, this is what is. So Rick on Sunday said, there are sort of two wings to daily practice. You have to be with what is, and you have to work with what is. And bringing what is, if that's tolerable, into meditation and sitting with it and saying, this is a bad mood. This is how a bad mood feels. And explore it, you know, like an itch or a pain in the body, you know. Watch how it changes. It isn't monolithic. Chances are it will become more intense and less intense, and your mind will wander. It will be there for a while, and then you'll be thinking about your groceries or your partner or your garden, and then you're in a bad mood again, you know. It's rare that a bad mood is truly monolithic and it lasts for the entire 45 minutes of your sitting, unbroken. So again, just paying attention to the anicca of the stimulus, even if the stimulus is unpleasant, can be a source of real insight. I found that as long as it took me to go through them, I go through most of these steps every time I sit. And it doesn't take very long at all. And the breathing and the intention, it's not a magic bullet, but it's very effective a lot of the time. Try it, you might like it. Yeah, hi. I think we're going to suffer whether we like it or not. I mean, suffering kind of comes with the package deal. I don't know as I buy into that particular axiom, but there is suffering in life, and you'll get your share whether you ask for it or not. I think that pain does not equal gain, and that it is certainly possible to gain through a positive experience. Ask Byron Katie. So, listen to your body, listen to your heart, and see what is really true for you. I don't think you'll be hurt by some happiness. It's not going to jeopardize your spiritual growth. It's after 9 o'clock. Thank you very much. If anybody needs to go, please feel free to go. If anybody wants to stay and ask more questions or come and look at my realia, I can hang out for a while. Thank you very much for coming.